Welcome to The Vinyl Preacher, your podcast where we talk about the Bible and make a playlist. I'm Zach Paris, coming to you from the most godless city in the American South, Asheville, North Carolina, where I'm looking high from my home office where I can see both a tattoo parlor and a record store. Matt's not with us due to his inability to be able to navigate time zones, which I'm taking great pleasure in. We're moving forward without Matt. Because this is a special episode of The Vinyl Preacher, I'm very excited that we have a guest with us today. You may know him from the Shutdown Fullcast, as the senior editor at The Athletic, a part of, somehow connected to the New York Times, the old gray lady, and author of, I think we can call it, I'm excited to find out, debut novel, Hell is a World Without You. Jason Kirk is with us today. Welcome to the podcast, Jason.
Hey, what's up, Zach? Thanks for having me in the so-called godless city, sunny city of Asheville that I am at a safe distance from, only viewing from afar.
it's you know, that's the reputation. My favorite part of the Righteous Gemstones a couple years ago is that Judy, BJ's sister, his family's from Asheville. At one point, it's just like one of those jokes they threw in at the like offhandedly. They make the comment that his family's from Asheville, and Judy and them are like, "Oh, that means they hate God." But having just moved here from Boulder, I am overwhelmed by how godly this city. It like grew up in the American South, lived in other places for like 15, 20-ish years, have moved back, and for a godless city. I've had people ask me like, where are you going to church? People I don't know well, churches on every corner. It feels like, all over the place, but
that is funny. Cause I mean, it's basically the Boulder of North Carolina, but it's still apparently feels more North Carolina than Boulder.
My wife recently started working in a kindergarten class, and for Thanksgiving, they ask, what are you thankful for? And this 5-year-old said, my heavenly home is what what they were thankful for, which she thought was interesting and not an answer we would have gotten in Boulder. So, so that's been really neat, interesting. I think is what I'm looking for as I read the novel, which is I don't know, brief synopsis-ish, my attempt at it. A novel that is set deeply within sort of like the evangelical early aughts. Presumably, I don't think there's a physical location. It feels like the South. I mean, I read it as the places I grew up in. Is that accurate-ish?
I set it as sort of a Anytown USA. And it's kind of interesting that people are reading it. Everyone who reads it sort of is sort of like, yeah, this seems like the people down the street from me. There is like one line in there where I set a location just in case anyone needs that. But if they miss it and it doesn't register, it's all the same to me. Cause like, to me, it's set in America. You know what I mean?
It's definitely America.
I didn't want to limit it to anywhere because to me it felt like if I said this is set in Metro Atlanta, right? And someone who reads it from, you know, California or Massachusetts or anywhere in between, they might think, oh, well, this is how Southerners act. You know, like we don't have any problems up here. We don't have any bigotry or religious or otherwise up here. And I just wanted to make it more applicable to everywhere because ultimately the setting is, I didn't really care where it was set geographically. Ultimately the setting is church.
And I think that's such a, like, on the podcast a lot of times one of the things we do talk about is preaching, right? Like, and in our context and how that ostensibly professional preachers listen to our podcast, all 14 of them. I mean, I think that's a thing you like hope for, right? In a novel, certainly, but in that sort of effective like communication, this like narrative and stuff, right? Is that like you know, it really wasn't until right now that I realized, oh, I don't think it actually said where it was, because I just assumed immediately, right, that it was my town, you know, and that it allowed me to enter into the narrative so quickly, like seamlessly. So congrats.
Yeah. That element of it came about because, like, early on in the writing process, about a year into the process, I brought up, I don't even remember what the anecdote was, but I was just talking about something that had happened in church that I was like, that it inspired a fictional moment or whatever. And whoever was listening to me talk about it at the time, they said, oh, that's how Southern Baptists do it, huh? And I'm like, well, A, yes, but also B, that happens in your mainline big box non-denominational church. It is not exclusive to this denomination over here. You know, it's not exclusive to this, like, quote unquote, bad guy denomination. This exact same thing in your extremely normie church. Because whatever, I don't remember exactly what it was, but I know that I wasn't talking about something specific to even conservatives or even, you know, even evangelicals. It was like something that's like bone deep in a lot of Western theology for the past 1,000+ years. You know what I mean? Like it was something having to do with like guilt or something. Yeah.
It's a recurring theme.
Yes.
How did you, right? So for folks who don't know, gosh, how would I describe you as someone who's consumed your work for a long time now? I guess it's sports writing, but it's not. I don't know. It's always been interested in creative sports writing that's been deeply engaging. And yet, right, when the book came out and stuff, I was a little surprised that it was a novel. Why, what were you thinking shifting into a novel in particular?
So, writing and editing and podcasting about sports for a number of years. And then thanks to the shutdown forecast, we go off topic, like wildly off topic all the time. And there are a few moments earlier in this podcast, like, you know, 8, 9, 10 years ago, where we talk about religion stuff. And every time we did, I noticed the list there was, you know, every time there'd be a segment of listeners who'd respond to it like, hey, wait a minute. I think we grew up pretty similar, you know? And, that gave me this sort of like, okay, people care about this and think it's interesting and not just like funny from a gawking outsider perspective, but also like people are saying like, whoa, that unlocked a memory and stuff like that, you know? And when you hear that, it's like, maybe I should keep going. And so, you know, that it sort of built and built until eventually my wife and I launched this like spinoff podcast where we're just going back through the Bible, like, and the point of it at first was just to have fun, but then we're like, oh, whoops, we're learning stuff. And then just that process of talking about it in public and talking about it with her for, you know, we've been married since we were adolescents, but like we only began talking about religion like after I started talking about it publicly. And I just kept finding that the things I would describe from my upbringing were just insane to her, but didn't. Yeah. But like, I felt like it didn't affect me at all. You know, like I told her about some of the craziest stuff that would happen at Wednesday night where, you know, there's like a nightmare theater and adults trying to scare children and like guns being waved around and, you know, just as crazy as evangelicalism can get. Like for anyone who has seen the Left Behind movies and can imagine, you know, adults trying to instill that fear into young people right in front of them. I told her about these things and she just couldn't believe them. And so I started trying to write them down. And I mean, like the fiction, making it fiction is interesting because I never started writing it down as nonfiction, like in a memoir style. Like for whatever reason, it came out as fiction from day one, from when it was very first, just like a 20-page Google Doc. And that might be because like I did creative writing in college, took some creative writing classes in college. Before sports journalism began. So maybe that for me was like, you know, closer to the source, right? Because like I went straight out of church to college where I'm learning creative writing. So maybe it felt connected already. Or maybe it was either that or it was like trying to distance it from the day job to just have some fun. I don't know. But for whatever reason, it came out immediately as fiction. And it sort of started with like this basic core story of like an antagonistic church authority figure and then a small handful of younger church people are sort of like finding themselves and coming together to oppose this person. And that was always the core of the story. And then I kept finding like, there's a lot to explain here. And, you know, even before I showed it to anyone, I was realizing like, I kind of get it. It kind of does sound insane. You know, like I remember I started thinking about like rapture fear and like, you know, those of us who grew up in certain churches, like, yeah, we spent large portions of our childhood scared to walk down the hall and see a pile of clothes because that would mean my parents had been raptured, you know, and I'd missed it. And now I'm stuck here while the Antichrist takes over. So like, how in the world do you explain that in 20 pages? You know, because that's like 5 pages right there. And like, how do you explain all the way back to Hal Lindsey and all the way back to John Nelson Darby and do all this stuff? And eventually I'm like, I said to Emily, my wife, I was like, I think I got to write a novel. And at that point, it was still just like, I just want to write it just to write it. You know, it wasn't any particular plans of I need anyone to read it. It was just like, I kind of want to just look at this and assess it.
Yeah.
And then eventually people started reading it and said it was good. And it just kept going. Next thing you know, there it is. Kirkus Reviews has reviewed it and whoa, I guess, wow, that means it's real. Yeah, it a couple people have asked before now, like why fiction instead of like a memoir. And I mean, you'll be the first person I'll actually give an answer to because I've just sort of thought about it. And I guess ultimately the thing for me was I didn't really think of myself as interesting. So like writing it as nonfiction, it's like that's for people who grew up in like actual cults. Like there's great memoirs about like escaping cults or like you know, surviving conversion therapy, you know, people who like did the stuff that's like levels beyond what I went through. It's not necessarily an accurate perspective because like you could write a memoir about any life experience and make it good if, you know, if it's good writing. But for me, it was just, I just had this perspective of like, I'm not interesting. I think I can write an interesting character who, you know, or an interesting group of characters who are similar to people like me in some way. I guess the other thing is I wanted to make it as universal as possible. So like, I didn't want to just limit it to my experiences. Like there's tons and tons of my memories that are, that inspired, you know, parts of this book. And like, there's tons of me and all of these characters, but at the same time, I wanted to draw in stuff that I'd heard from people I grew up with, people who grew up like me in other parts of the country and other denominations. Things I read in books by, you know, Linda K. Klein or Rachel Held Evans or, you know, these other people who have written great nonfiction books about that world. So I wanted to sort of try to tie all that together. And it felt like if it was just me, then it would feel like there'd be a lot about, you know, like, which secular hip hop artists did I like the most? Cause that was like one of my main concerns as a kid. And it's like, well, that's not really relevant to the main story here. I mean, it's relevant in the sense that like I liked secular hip hop and that was a little bit of a foothold out of, you know, cause I'm hearing people of color, create songs about like police brutality and, you know, and income inequality and like, all that was eye openers. But like, the amount of time I put into my rap opinions as a young person wouldn't fit the specific book. So it's like, let's make a character who has fewer rap opinions, you know, just for one example or whatever.
I did introduce this as a debut novel. So maybe we've stumbled upon, that's a little bit of pressure that there's a second novel already, but maybe it's about adolescent rap opinions.
Yeah, I mean, it is funny. Like in this book, I was thinking about this. The main character, he and I are, you know, different in a lot of ways. The music is the one that sticks out to me the most where it's like, I think there's like a scene where he's like very disgusted by nu metal. And I'm like, yeah, I relate to it so deeply to that because like, you know, I was a youth during the nu metal craze. And it was like you had the metalcore kids and the nu metal kids. And they were just like, to an outsider, it sounds the same, but to us, it was like, oh, no, incredibly different. But like the music in it, if it was about me, there'd be so much more, like, I guess a lot of the theology would be replaced by music. A lot of the like thinking about C.S. Lewis and thinking about Origen and thinking about Gregory of Nyssa that goes on in the book would be replaced by like, thinking about Big Punisher, I guess, but
I mean, that's the point of this podcast, really, is to put Gregory of Nyssa in conversation with Big Punisher.
You know, if John Calvin is right, then is God himself not the Big Punisher? That's what I've always
said. Oh, that's good. That's good.
But yeah, like, I guess, I don't know. It just felt, doing fiction instead of nonfiction, it just felt like a way to honestly dig deeper into my experiences than if I'd done just straight nonfiction. Cause you have to like recontextualize and rethink. And like, you have to think like, why was this different than what someone else experienced? And, you know, you have to incorporate so much more stuff than it's just drawing directly on nothing but your own memories, I guess.
Yeah. One of my reflections, again, shaped by relocating to the South, is like how cultural, like that dynamic, like that, like, what are the words for it? Like how cultural the dynamic that the book really like lives in is and was. I have questions about is, like, I feel disconnected enough that I don't, like, I wonder, like, is this still like what it's, because it definitely is what what my experience was like in the early aughts and late 90s, right? That's what that was. Like, I wonder if it still is. But I also like wonder about like how, I don't even know if wonder, just suspect it was so cultural. Like, I grew up in mainline Protestant churches, like in Lutheran churches, and I did the thing, you know, growing up where you move to the youth groups based on your romantic attractions.
Sure.
And so, which I want to get to, actually, because I've got, like, I mean, I think that's what makes it so good. But, right, so, like, I remember real distinctly, like, as a United Methodist, the establishment United Methodist Church in our small town, their youth group, we watched the Left Behind movies and stuff there. Right, like, even if the rap, like, even back then, the United Methodist Church didn't lead with rapture theology, right? But, like, this is what it was, and this is what it is, right? I remember at a separate United Methodist Church where I was doing, like, confirmation stuff, one of my classmates brought in a DC talk, and the, like, 100-year-old pastor, like, stormed out of the confirmation session because of how insane it was, right? and, you know, there are, like, degrees of it. Like, I would go to, I had another friend. My street cred here is that I was kicked out of Vacation Bible School.
Nice.
Yeah. In probably sixth grade, I think, at not at First Baptist, but it'd be like a 3.5 ist Baptist church, because I, having previously really been in Jurassic Park, would not let the dinosaur thing go one time. You're not going to tell me that dinosaurs didn't exist, because I spent a whole lot of time on this and I've done my research. And so I was not invited back by, ironically, his real name was Pastor Cool. C-O-O-L was not cool at all. But just like how it wasn't like confined, like it was the, I mean, it's so like when Isaac goes to school and like, he's trying to push back against the godless establishment of the school, and the teacher's like, "Well, I have a Bible, right? Like, what do you? I have a Bible on my desk. Like, what are you like trying so hard? All the schools that like meet at the poll and stuff, right? Like, it's, I mean, it's such an important dynamic of that, I think.
Yeah, like that's how I remember it, and it's sort of what I tried to reflect, is this sense that we were told that you were going to be persecuted at public school, right? And I went to, I was like homeschooled in middle school, so it was like, it was this extra level of fear going to public school, you know, because it's like, oh my God, I've been warned about this my entire life by Christian adults, and I don't even have the experience of middle school, you know what I mean? So, and then you get there, and it's like, oh, it's kind of loud, I guess, but everyone's... No one's yelling at me. No one's called me a name because I'm a Christian. Like, no one cares. Like, there's a huge FCA. There's a huge stance at the poll. The freaking lead singer of Third Day is from the school, and he comes by to visit us. You know, like, and like by junior year, it's like, Oh, okay. So all the Christian punk kids and all the secular punk kids just hang out and no one cares, you know? So it's this huge eye opener where it's like all the persecution stuff was all fake, you know? And that sort of, it sort of helps all the other fake stuff to fall away as well. But yeah, that pop culture stuff being everywhere, sort of like transcending just quote unquote evangelical churches and, you know, and finding their way to mainline churches. And I've heard from like people who are like, I grew up Catholic and I was surprised how much of this stuff I knew, you know? And I've heard from people who are like, I've never been to church at all, but I remember my classmates bringing all this stuff to school and I didn't know anything about it, but now I do. So like, it's been fun to sort of, talk to just a wide range of people about like, oh yeah, everyone remembers Reliant K, you know, whether we like whether they were the only band you were allowed to listen to, or you didn't want to listen to them at all, or you just genuinely liked them, everyone remembers them. But it is, I like when you say like, is it different now versus then? I think it is different now, because like in that window of like mid-90s to mid-aughts, it was like the evangelical market stuff was just, was legit huge, you know? Like not just the Left Behind books and Left Behind movies and not just DC Talk and Jars of Clay, but I mean, you know, the Christian rap group Grits was in like actual huge films, and like there were POD and lots of other rock bands around MTV, and Switchfoot was crossing over, and Amy Grant, Kirk Franklin, and like, you know, it was just everywhere. It was huge. MXPX was crossing over, but and then it sort of just all stopped crossing over, you know, it all just went back to being insular. And it's kind of fascinating. And it's a thing you could ponder and argue forever about, like, who made it go back to being insular? Were they sick of Christians, or were Christians like, hang on, we got too many young people following MXPX out the door. We need to settle down here.
Well, and Matt and I have talked about it a bit too. Like, and before we started recording, we were talking about Coachella, and we noticed at Coachella this past year that like, they're definitely with the whole, like with, there's a racial element to things. I don't know if you've heard about this recently.
I've heard the term.
In a number of areas, there might be a racial dynamic. We're at Coachella, and like, you know, pretty, known as a fairly secular music festival. And we were at shows, and like black artists would all of, like one, I forget who it was. Maybe it was a no name, just started like preaching, right? Like is using God language, you know, and a part of it, right, is lots of the, like lots of black musicians come up playing in the church in ways that white musicians don't. But then we'd hear like white musicians, we heard a couple of them like address religious stuff, and it was so striking, like how different the perspective was. That it was a thing that they needed to like explain or step away from. Like they did work to like create distance somehow, or acknowledge different distance in ways that in particular are in our anecdotal experience, black folks did not feel the need it was just so different. Yeah.
Well, it feels like a lot of, for a lot of black artists, there's a sense that like religion is this like, uniting thing, you know, where it's like ultimately talking about God because, you know, we are all, it's sort of like, it's like an overall all encompassing thing where for a lot of white artists, they come from, if they have religion in their background, there's a good chance it was from an exclusionary.
Not a fun time. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it was about like building walls and building barriers. And like, I mean, it's certainly my experience that religion was us saying, we, because of how hard we are trying, are doing this better than other people are. And also there's this huge political element that, you know, we're connected to political ideologies that say those people are also bad for other reasons, right? We're like, you know, in the black church, if there's a political connotation, it's very likely like, you know, solidarity with other communities, you know? So I guess it feels to me like it would make sense for artists from those communities to not feel like they need to apologize for, you know, for referencing religion. 'Cause I would imagine for a lot of them, it still feels like a, something that the whole audience has in common, at least in their background in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have to say, I love Alexa for a lot of reasons, but I think my main takeaway kind of like that gets embodied in Alexa is this. Alexa's kind of is a very not churchy kid who gets forced to go to church for like a year. There's kind of like a year deadline, but she keeps going after the year. And like, oh man, like it. I mean, that's the thing that like, I'm in a weird spot, right? But I did a lot of, went to seminary, did professional ministry things. Like, it's so close to be, I mean, and in a lot of ways, like, as you said, right, they're finding themselves coming together. Like, in a lot of ways, the church in the novel is facilitating that, right? Like, it gets so close to like being such a positive thing, but it's not. Like, but you know, like, but messes it up, you know, like, and that feels so true to my like experience of my personal experience, but also, you know, I was the campus pastor working with students at the University of Colorado, right, and seeing that in the lives of other young adults of you know, who came through and stuff, right, is that it's so close to being a net good, right? And yet, right, it's it messes it up, you know, which is heartbreaking, really.
Yeah. My writing my character Alexa, she, like, there are things that she and I do not have in common. She's like, you know, the most popular girl at school, which none of those words ever applied to me.
Well, when I read it, I read that as you. You were that.
Yeah, I actually was the prom queen. It was I'm very proud to have done that. But so she's sort of a like a Regina George with a heart of gold is sort of the idea here. And like the things I identify with her is this sense of like, I do not want to be in this building, but I need the people in this building very badly, right? Like I had a lot of eras during my time at church that felt very much like that, where it's like, this place is infuriating, makes me hate myself. I feel shame and guilt and fear, and I cannot stand the time it takes up and all this stuff. Also, this is where all my friends are, so I'm happy to be here because now we're going to go do something fun. And I have crushes on literally half of this building. And you know what I mean? Where my band practices, and you know, yeah. So like, that sense of like, I need this community and I hate the building that it meets in is, she's absolutely one of my favorite characters. That, and she calls everything how she sees it. She cusses the most of anyone, which makes her the funnest to write. So
it's pretty similar to the mom. I like the mom too a lot. Like there's a line, where she wants to be it's right after, spoilers, well, I won't spoil that part.
We could say at some point, we could say, all right, we've entered spoiler zone. That's totally fine.
Spoiler zone, where it's Josiah, right? Isaac's friend kind of gets outed. And the line is like that she wants to be a Rush Limbaugh, but also wants to be liked by people who remind her of her adolescence. And I thought that whole like chapter like was just I mean, it's all like, it made me feel right. So good job there. But it also like, I mean, in part of one of the feelings is like frustration with like reality, you know, because the mom character comes across in that scene. So, in that chapter, so fully human in that, like, I know that's what most people are like, you know, like, or so many people are like, in my experience in the South, I'll claim that, of, you know, she's listening to Rush Limbaugh and this kid comes out and she's supportive and like, yeah, I mean, she's supportive. I think I'd say that. Right. Like yeah, she's able to hold those two things together. Right.
Yeah.
And it's just frustrating, to know that, you know, to know so many people like that mom character, and like maybe we could be a little like, maybe like, if that's who you really are, which, you know, so often I've seen those people reveal themselves to be that person. Maybe we could lead with the, affirming part and not with the rush part. Like, again, it's like that, it's that unfulfilled potential of like, oh, we're so close to being like not douchebags.
Writing her, the protagonist's mom, it was sort of like she was a constant battle between there's this person she thinks she's supposed to be and there's this person she is. And I wanted it to suck when like she is clearly being drawn toward the person she's supposed to be, like, and I wanted her to go on a journey over the course of the book. At the same time, I didn't want to like batter the reader with homophobic slurs. So we're not, you know, and it never felt
again,
authentic.
There's a second novel coming.
Yeah, it'll be nothing but the most offensive stuff ever. Mm-hmm. Just no. It never felt authentic for me that she would be outright hateful, but mm-hmm. having her sort of struggle with like, am I allowed to be affirming? You know, and like she mm-hmm. wants to. This is her son's friend. You know, this is one of her son. This is like her son's like a decent kid, like sort of a big brother, social mentor type figure. Like she's seen her son like sort of blossom socially thanks to this kid. And you know, so like she wants to be defensive of this kid. And like we see at various points, she's protective of Alexa. She, you know, she's like, she sort of adopts all the local blockheads named Caleb. But like we see her wanting to be this like community den mom. So she wants to reach out and protect Josiah. But how frustrating is it that a mother doesn't know whether she's allowed to defend her son's friend? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
what a thing that this world has done to her brain, you know?
Yeah. Oh, it's so frustrating. So good. Here's my big theory, okay, that I came up with. A thing that I, so the Shutdown Fullcast, how long has the Shutdown Fullcast been up? I don't even know how, like, I tried to like look, do research today to like figure out like when it, and it's so, it's been a while, right?
It's just over 10 years as of now, yeah.
All right. And Shutdown Fullcast, of course, spawned from, God, I gotta tell you, Jason, I love the Shutdown Fullback so much. It was so insane. And that is my particular taste, and it nailed it. Absurdist sort of college football podcast that's, you know, come from a lot of really neat places. The thing that I like about the Fullcast and what it, like, and the Fullcast ethos is, and what I think I see a bit in the novel, and that I see in this podcast is in my and Matt's kind of approach to the Bible, the Christian tradition, is like this, like it's a deconstruction of a sacred thing that college football, you know, they're all jokes and stereotypes about it's a religion and stuff, right? And we don't need to go fully down that road. But I think with a fairly broad understanding of what's sacred, it's a thing that a lot of people think is really important. Right? And what the Fullcast has does, right, is it takes it apart, pokes fun at it, reveals how absolutely insane it is. And yet it's done with it doesn't stop at like the deconstruction and the absurd, right? Like it pushes through, I think, to, and yet like there's an affection, but also like there is meaning in this thing. Like if it's a sacred thing, right, it's a thing that people think is really important, that makes it important. And if we're all like here taking all the parts apart, like there must be a reason we're doing this, and there's something to find to get there. As a college chaplain, that was always the hardest part, right? Like with this kind of students that I'd encounter, like in Boulder, who had a different disposition than people on the street, even here in godless Asheville, who I had to convince, we're not like whatever you think we're like, eager to do the deconstruction piece, right? Like, oh, okay. Yeah. Tell me about the ancient Near East. Let's take all the parts. Like, yeah, it's a metaphor, right? Always the hardest to be like, okay, well, we're going to take it all apart, but like, how do we push through to this next, to this meaning deep thing? And so I wonder, you know, trying to phrase in the form of a question here. I see that in the full cast. I feel like there are bones and elements of that in the novel and its approach to the church, the Christian tradition, evangelicalism. Is that, how does that feel?
Yeah, I mean, I think that description of the full cast is one of the best I've ever heard. That sense that, like, this thing is worth taking apart because we love it. You know? And the parts that matter are not which teams win and which teams lose. You know, the things that people feel the worst about. The parts that matter are, it brings us together. It gives us something to do on Saturdays. It's something we look forward to. It's something we can laugh about. And we can hope it's enriching for the athletes, and, you know, we hope they get something out of it other than just happy memories if their team wins. and hopefully something beyond just scholarships, but, you know, there is something good and beautiful and wonderful here. And the fact that it is weird is worth celebrating. And the fact that so many bad institutions have, and I don't necessarily mean just colleges, but, you know, bad portions of society have wormed their way into the sport. That is also, I mean, that's worthy of mockery. So, right. So now we're laughing on two different levels, right? We're celebrating a wacky thing that happened in this game, and we're mocking, you know, various horrible societal systems that have glommed their way onto this thing. So that's a lot to laugh about right there. And you can do all that without being like cynical about the actual thing, you know, without being cynical about the thing at the core. And I think that, I mean, that translates to the novel in a lot of ways. Like, there's literally a refrain in there, like, anything that can be built can be rebuilt better. And like, I mean, if we're talking about deconstruction, for me, that was a thing that took me a long time to actually learn, probably longer than actually after I wrote it, right? Like, you write something, you're like, oh, that sounds great, that's wise. And then a couple, you know, a year or two later, you're like, oh, I'm supposed to actually do that, you know? Because like, for me, deconstructing religion was like, well, I just left. That's it. You know, there was no actual contextualization, or like, let me clean my brain up, or, you know, let me get rid of this patriarchal mindset that had been locked in there for like, you know, like 6 or 7 years after I stopped attending church. You know, like, there was no actual cleanup or rebuilding or coming to terms with anything. It was just, I just left, you know? So that whole post deconstruction thing for me was like a long, long time, half my life, you know? And I wouldn't say I actually made any progress on it until, you know, a couple years into writing this thing and a couple years into hosting a Bible podcast. As funny as that sounds to me right now, it's completely true. It was only within the past year or so that I got to a point where I'm like, okay, I think I have a, you know, not a final destination, but at least somewhere to stand for now, you know? And I'm no longer defined by where I was and running from it. I can now stand somewhere and look back on it while we think about where we're going next, you know? And like, I know, and like, I'm never going to say I know everything about God. It's just sort of like, I know I have enough of an understanding of my idea of how God relates to me that I can function with that idea, you know, while I continue thinking about how it relates to me. And it's become a lot less about, that was bad and therefore anything is better, and more like, well, let's find what's good. And like, you know, in the novel, just because of when it's set, so much of it is about deconstruction. And then sort of, since we're in spoiler zone, toward the end, we get, you know, we get bits of reconstruction and new stuff. And we sort of end with like an epiphany moment, and then we have an epilogue. But like taking the thing apart is one thing. And I guess the full cast has been a 10-year deconstruction of college football while also loving everything that we possibly can about it. The novel, of course, is the same thing, while also loving a lot of things about church. You know, I tried to dump in as much empathy toward the people as I possibly could, even a couple of the antagonists. And like, so much of the stuff that is very easy to make fun of is, you know, it's like, I mean, I still like a lot of those bands. There's literally an MXPX right over my corner, Outkast poster. So like, a lot of that stuff is still like, no, it's fine. It's fine that that's part of me. And you know, you can like cringe and be embarrassed and guilty pleasure the stuff that you still feel fine holding on to, or you can just say like, no, it's fine. It's fine that I still hold on to it.
That's my, like, one of my milk, what is it? Soapbox, not milk. I don't put milk in that box. You put soap in a box. Milk crate, soapbox. From my time in Boulder on campus, it hit that thread of my experience that, like, gosh, I maybe it's my sharpest critique of Christianity, is as a whole, right, is how completely disproportional, like, the idea of belief and how critical, like, belief is to it, right? So, like, I've told the story a bunch of times. We had Eboo Patel on campus from Interfaith Youth Corps a long time ago, and he used some really particular language that I thought was intriguing, that he started talking about religious identity. And so, like, we had a meeting with Interfaith students after he left, and we did the, like, sit in a circle thing, and I was facilitating, and I asked the students very particularly to include their religious identity in their introduction. And, like, so they did the real formulaic thing that college students do, right? Like, my name, my major, my hometown, this class, and then they added on religious identity, right? And so I knew most of the students pretty well. I knew their backgrounds, and so we started, like, they did their thing, and, like, I'm Muslim, went through, I'm Jewish, I'm Roman Catholic, and then we got to, like, my students who came from my group, whose backgrounds I knew the most intimately, and they changed the formula, and it was just the most fascinating thing, right? That all of a sudden they're like, well, I grew up Methodist, but I'm not sure what I believe anymore.
Yeah.
Right. All of a sudden they didn't have an identity, right? Like they felt the ability to have identity based on whether they believe something or not. Right. Like, give or take, like, I can take it or leave it. And that really changed, like, what I hoped for in my professional religious work with students was to help them, Christian students in particular, to see that the identity is you, like, I love the recovering Catholic. I don't necessarily love that exists, right? But I think it's really helpful, like, identity, because it says, hey, this thing has shaped me, and I can't, like, we don't get to just pretend that these things that have shaped us don't shape us, because they'll continue to do so, right? So, like, saying it out loud helps. But to say, like, the Christian tradition belongs to you. You can do with it whatever you want, right? Not, like, whether you believe or not, your identity is at stake. Like, that's a really high stakes game that's not, you know, in addition to not being true, not healthy or helpful. So, like, to say, like, this is yours. Like, it belongs to you. You get to do with it whatever you want. And you might as well take it apart and see what you like or don't like in it.
Yeah. Like, when so much of, you know, like you say, your identity is tied up in the entire checklist of things you are supposed to affirm on a level so deeply that you feel there is no way they could ever be impossible. You know, it's like, as a young person in that world, you have that sense of, like, so hang on, the Hebrew Bible, which we called it the Old Testament at the time, it's like, there's almost nothing in there about what I'm supposed to believe. It's just like, you know, it's like, you should, here's a story. And here's a guy saying, don't kill anyone. And here's a long story. And here's, like, 300 pages about how you should be nice to poor people. And here's another story. And then some stuff blows up and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And nowhere in there is it like, you have to believe this. You have to think this is true. You have to say this thing that someone will tell you is wrong is actually true. If an atheist comes up to you, no one knew what an atheist was at the time. You know, like, it's not about, it's not about the importance of belief. And then you get to the New Testament, and, like, you know, so much of the Gospels, with a bit of an exception, are about, like, Jesus literally saying, I am going to make this as simple as I possibly can. Take care of poor people. I'm going to say this in the starkest metaphor I have, because you're not getting it. Take care of poor
people.
Sorry,
you're breaking up, Jesus. I can't. I didn't catch that. I didn't.
And then Paul is, you know.
Your mic might be off, Jesus.
And then Paul's kind of, you know, at times he's flowering, confusing a little bit. I get it. And then here comes James to say, like, no, seriously, I'm going to say it even more bluntly than Jesus did. If you're not taking care of poor people, you're doing religion wrong, right? And so you're a kid consuming all that, And you're like, why are we obsessed with belief, right? And then, well, someone points at the Gospel of John. And you're like, oh, right, that's the best one. It's got John 3:16 in it. It's the important one. That's the key. So, okay, it's all about belief. Let me push my brain until it never doubts any of this stuff. And then eventually, maybe many years later, you learn, like, hey, John was written a bit later when people are starting to think, like, wait, is Jesus coming back or not? And so it doesn't mean that, you know, and it doesn't mean the Gospel of John is inauthentic or wrong or anything. It just means their authors selected different things to emphasize, you know. And like, if we had known that at the time, we could know, like, okay, there's a reason that Mark is so focused on action and Luke is so focused on society and Matthew's so focused on this prophetic heritage and John is so focused on, like, you know, big mystical stuff. And like, if we'd had that sense that these are different perspectives written for different reasons at different times, two different audiences, you know, then you don't have to worry about, I have to feel the exact same way about all of it, you know? And then like where I grew up, it was in, you know, in a lot of traditions that are similar to mine, it's, you have to believe not only all this religious stuff, but all this political stuff, this mm-hmm. very specific political stuff, you know, and you have to feel it and know it and know that you know that you know, which is a term that I heard about a million times. And it's like, what do you do if you literally can't? What do you do?
Yeah.
But like, when people are like, just have faith. I have been thinking about religion my entire life. I have no idea what have faith means. No clue. I could not begin to write down a definition of what it is that people mean when they say that. And for me as a kid, that was just, I mean, almost literally brain breaking, which I, you know, I tried to capture at points in the book. Is like, I mean, there's a point early on, fairly early on, where the narrator just has like a meltdown trying to define what Christianity is, because he thinks the fate of the universe depends on him understanding what it is he's supposed to be doing here, and he can't.
And that's the kind of stakes that young adults need to be playing, yeah. Right? That's the right amount of pressure for people with yeah. underdeveloped frontal lobes.
Yeah, this nation depends on my generation seizing it for Christ. And, we're gonna missionary save the world, and then there's probably some other planets we need to baptize, and yeah, and all of this depends on me knowing like exactly the correct sinner's prayer that correctly fixed my soul at whichever point, and but if I doubted that it was fixed, then it wasn't actually fixed, and I never meant it. And like, you get all these, you know, when we obsess with like individual salvation instead of like doing what's in the Bible, you get tripped up and trapped by all this, like, have I done enough to not go to hell? When it's about, Jesus said, take care of poor people.
And sorry, again, you're cutting out.
He keeps breaking up. It's crazy. But like, Jesus didn't say, you know, Jesus never said, you must establish whether you think my birth was of a virgin or not, or else. He never said that, you know, he never mm-hmm. said that. Like, Jesus never said you must go to this kind of church, to that kind of church, never said you must decide whether this thing I'm doing is a metaphor or literal. It was, I don't know, it's so much of it being about belief is, it's supposed to make it easy, right? Like, it's supposed to make it a low demand religion where it's like, yeah, I don't have to do anything. I just show up on Sunday and say, I agree, and then I'm fine, you know? Dumb. But it actually makes it harder.
If you, I don't you know take if it I'm seriously, it's awful. Yeah.
I don't know if I'm in the club or not, you know? Yeah. So yeah.
Full disclosure things. And confession, right? Like, so reading all that stuff, like, this is where Lutherans get on their high horse. Cause that's like Luther's existential crisis, right? So Luther, in addition to being chronically constipated, was also probably, are you familiar with that? Like, he wrote the 95, like not 95 theses, maybe 95. No, not yet. Later on, he wrote most of his stuff on the toilet. Because he grew up like really fairly poor, eating, you know, like sawdust bread and stuff. And then all of a sudden he's eating meats. Yeah. Anyway, in addition to that, you know, probably like had some severe depression, and wrestled with that same like sort of existential, like dread crisis stuff. Right. And so, Lutherans are always like, oh, if only we could just expose people to our theology that answers this problem everybody has. And I always get so mad at myself when my subconscious is like, why doesn't Isaac just read the Book of Concord?
Yeah,
man, this would really open him up.
Which I kind of actually anticipated. I had him like terrified of Calvinists. I mean, obviously there's different traditions, but still,
I mean, I think like, we all are appropriately terrified of Calvinists.
Adam like terrified of quote unquote systematic theology, you know? So it's sort of like, this is the one thing that would have fit his brain. Someone coming along and saying like, oh, here, I've boiled it down to a math equation, but he's set up to be terrified of predestination. So not even that's going to work for him.
Lutherans in the early writings actually get like really into like the biggest insult you could call someone was a crypto Calvinist. I still enjoy tossing around from time to time. Slight side note in that I think believe is a really weak translation in John for what the gospel is. Like I just think there's like it's that like vined branches metaphor is what he's really trying to go for. And it's a like this is the best English word we have, and we screwed that up a lot. But we had Rob Saylor, who teaches at, I think it's called Christian Theological Seminary in Indianapolis, who wrote a book on Radiohead, religion and Radiohead, that's really good. And he had a fantastic line that I loved about how like the church has always been like in the music business, right? That like the church is the patron of the arts, that Bach, right, was working for the church, Michelangelo, Raphael, all the Ninja Turtles employed by the church. And but that now, like, if you use Christian as an adjective to describe art, it means like slightly inferior, right? Like you just substitute like Christian music for like not as good as the real thing, whatever it is, right? As we get towards the end of our time here, my question for you, the book ends appropriately with a playlist. So I'm excited for that. I appreciate that I assume it was a shout out. having been through the obstacle course, the proven grounds that was the Christian music scene of the late 90s and early 2000s, my personal question for you, Jason, where do you find yourself musically these days?
So it's weird. Like I hip hop was like my number one genre for almost all of my life. And then at some point I don't want to say I like aged out of it or got like, it's definitely not, I'm too mature for it. I'm still into all, you know, I literally have comic books behind me. It's not that I'm an adult now. Maybe I don't have the attention span for it. You know,
I mean,
it's
you are like, wearing a smoking jacket and have a pipe, but comic books. Yes.
It's like, it might just be, there's so many words. I there's so much content. I'm scrolling Twitter right now. I can't pay attention to all these words. I don't know. So like mainly I listen to, any metal band that has like something else going on. I'm probably going to be into like, there's this local band called the Callous Dow Boys, incredibly chaotic metalcore band. Well, they're, you know, they remind me of Between the Buried and Me from Closer to You, a Charlotte band where it's like, yeah, it's metal, but like, here's some mariachi for no good reason, you know, just sort of thrown in there. and then a band like Zeal and Ardor, which they tried to combine, black metal with Delta blues and it's amazing, or like Death Heaven where it's like black metal with shoegaze, you know, or this band Rollo Tomasi, which sounds like if you mixed a metal band like Zayo or Carcass with churches. Like it's singer, she has this like beautiful melodious voice and this disgusting metal snarl. It's great. So like either that or like just any lady pop music, you know, Carly Rae Jepsen, Boy Genius, Olivia Rodrigo, Paramore, Maggie Rogers, like any, like if it's dudes, they have to be yelling and screaming. Otherwise I mostly listen to lady music. Those are, and if it's in between like Rollo Tomasi, then perfect. I'll listen to that all day long.
I like lady music. I personally was born, too late. I should have been born at Lilith Fair. So I appreciate the lady music myself. The book is available to be purchased in a capitalistic society, I believe, in exchange for US dollars.
I think there are other websites that will take other currencies as well, but yeah.
Okay, well that's good. How many Bitcoin does it sell for? What's the primary way to purchase the book? I know it's on Amazon.
It is on Amazon. Anyone who'd prefer not to do business there, it's on Bookshop. It's on anywhere else. If you want to buy it directly, we still have ebooks available at shutdownfullbooks.com. Those are also pay what you want. And since all money is going to the Trevor Project, if anyone goes beyond, I think those are $5 there, but if anyone goes beyond $5, then that's more that'll end up being donated to the Trevor Project. We're at, we've sent them $39,000 in proceeds so far, and number will be bigger. We don't know what it'll be at the end. There's still some accounting to do, but it'll be a bit more than that at least.
Fantastic. Is there a date? Isn't there a date with the Trevor Project? You gotta buy the book before
February 12th is what we're treating as the cutoff, and sort of at that point we'll decide, like, all right, what do we do with the money after that? But we haven't really thought that far ahead, but but at that point everything that is in there right now will go to the Trevor Project.
Sweet. So be sure to buy it before February 12th, or else you're against the Trevor Project. That's the only way that I can read.
If you buy it after that, I'm just going to waste the money on like novelty Doritos flavors and other stupid stuff I spend money on. So
yeah, worst of all worlds, you don't buy it at all. You're against the Trevor Project and Doritos, which is a tough spot to be in.
Powerful enemies.
Well, Jason, thanks so much for being with us today on the podcast.
Thanks, Zach. This was very fun.